Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today, we are talking to three friends from Santa Fe nonprofits. Karen Rowell is here from Youth Shelters and Family Services of Santa Fe, Carol Norton from Wild Earth Guardians, and joining us by telephone for just a little while, Diane Karp from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here, and especially with these other outstanding nonprofits.
Oh, thank you, and thank you, Mary Charlotte. Can't wait to... Thanks for having us.
So let's start with Diane, because you are actually rushing off to catch an airplane. So we want to start and ask you, you are a nonprofit. All of us, and the reason we're talking today, are operating in what we might call a new economic climate, namely one of economic recession, downturn, and some fear. What is changing for you, Diane, as the director of an arts organization?
Well, Mary Charlotte, I think that all of us who are on this program together would probably say that one of the things that has happened over the past 10 years is that nonprofits have been measured and qualified in terms of their success by the amount of money they make, the amount of money they raise, and how much they can grow in terms of financial worth. And one of the things that's been, I guess, left out of the equation for whatever reasons, but I think to the detriment of the services that we can provide to the community, is whether or not we actually meet our mission. Do we deliver what we say we deliver? How many people do we help? How do we help them? What is our impact on the community? And I'm sorry, I'm a little out of breath. In light of that, one of the things that then happens is that we begin to monetarize, make everything into a money value, instead of thinking about whether or not we are doing important work. And I think that what's going to happen with this kind of an economy is that we're going to begin at last to move away from, sorry, I'm on radio, to move away from the measure of the nonprofit sector in terms of cash value, and begin to rethink the importance of the nonprofit sector in terms of delivering essential services to keep the society healthy.
Well, there was that Wall Street Journal article which actually said that there are a lot of nonprofits that are being measured by people who do this kind of measuring so that donors can say, well, gee, who should we give our money to? Where is it going to be most worthily spent? And they don't even measure by on the basis of, because they don't have a way to calculate whether an organization is fulfilling its mission or not, which is crazy.
Exactly. But I think that what will begin to happen is that people will indeed begin to meet their, you know, focus more on their mission and less on the issues that have actually distracted us. Thank you. Distracted us from doing what we do and doing it well.
So as an arts organization, and Diane, tell us when you have to go, because we know that you're already at the airport and literally about to get on a plane. But as an arts organization, what is your mission at the Santa Fe Art Institute?
The Art Institute's mission really is to explore those places where the contemporary arts and society come together. And that's a very important activity, because what we address are issues of social justice, cultural freedom, and environmental responsibility. And within that context, what we are doing is we are giving voice to sectors of the cultural community that would normally not have a direct access to the general audience. And by that, I mean that, you know, oftentimes artists, whether they're visual artists or writers or poets or performers or filmmakers, often function as our voice of conscience. And by doing that, they have this way of raising essential issues and allowing us not only the time to think about those issues, but a way to engage slowly out of the direct sort of political sector.
And this brings up a question which I'm also going to raise with
I'm going to put the phone down for a minute, and it's going to go through the I'm not going to hang it up.
She's going through airport security, ladies and gentlemen. So, it brings up something that I'd like to bring up with Carol Norton and Carol Rowe, which is, what is a necessity and what is a luxury? When we talk about, for example, the environment, what is Wild Earth Guardian's mission?
That's a great question, and what Diane says is exactly right. What's important and essential is that we move to a sustainable community, and a sustainable community is our relationship to nature, it's our relationship to the arts, it's our relationship to the people in the community who don't have everything they need to make it day to day. Our mission is to protect and restore wildlife and wild lands, and it's a piece, an essential piece of the whole sustainable community. And without that, without a sustainable community, we won't have a sustainable economy.
Very interesting.
Well, we come at it from really a very basic level, is that we're providing services to kids who don't have a safety net, and we become their safety net. So on a very basic level, we're providing them with food, warm clothing, in our shelter, a place to stay. When they've been kicked out of their houses, we're trying to find them places to live and help them get a job. So it's really very, start out in many of our programs with really basic services and then try to work up. So the sustainability for our organization is to be able to do that.
It's interesting, with this trio of the arts and social services and the environment, you kind of start to get a sense of what is the fabric of our lives. What is the infrastructure on which we depend, both economic, physical, and spiritual, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what people are beginning to realize is that the environment is directly related to the economy, is directly related to our spiritual selves, to the people in our community. And if we don't participate in all of them, then none of us will be fully healthy. That, you know, when I say that environment, for instance, is directly related to economy, a lot of the work that we do right now is clearing the way for the new economy. So when we go to, particularly in our climate and energy program, which we started up last year, but in all of our programs, we are working to clear the way to against the old economy. We're fighting the forces of the past so that we can create something new and innovative and sustainable that will work for everybody.
And you know, for our young people to really focus on the environment, focus on the world around them, we first have to come in and provide some kind of stability and basic needs so that they don't just spend their day looking for a safe place to stay or some food or to find a warm jacket, so that then they can expand their consciousness, look out into the world, look at what's a sustainable job, what are we doing for our environment. And so it really comes, you know, it's a holistic way that, you know, with the three of us sitting here, that really we have to attend to.
We're talking to Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute, Carol Norton from Wild Earth Guardians, and Karen Rowell of Youth Shelters and Family Services. So what have, Diane, when you are looking at the way things are now compared to a year ago, what is similar and what is different for you as a nonprofit?
Our programs serve the creative community in a variety of ways, and we are not willing, if we can possibly manage it, to cut any of them. We serve artists and writers by providing residencies, by providing workshops. We have an incredible education and outreach program in the schools and in the shelters and in the other organizations in and around Santa Fe, from literally Santa Fe to Albuquerque and the youth detention centers. And what we are doing, quite literally, is trying to cut back the costs while still maintaining the programs And that's a real challenge. But I think these challenges sometimes make us do our jobs better and more thoughtfully. And the whole idea of collaboration really ends up being an incredibly powerful force. So it makes us try and figure out ways that we can solve common problems together.
You know, I'd like to comment on what Diane just said, because, you know, nonprofits always operate on a shoestring. And when people talk about making budget cuts, you kind of look around and you go, well, let's see if we bought one less roll of toilet paper. That we, our budgets are so tight anyway. And I think as the nonprofit community over the last 5 or 6 years has done, is talked a lot about collaboration, looked in that direction. And in this economic climate, we have to do it. And we have to really look where somebody's doing something and we might think about doing and say, absolutely not. They do it better than us. Or ways that we can share costs or, you know, really, really make a concerted effort not to duplicate services, because it's the only way there, you know, the foundations are they're having their struggles, that we're looking at budget cuts. And so, you know, the nonprofit community has got to collaborate and not duplicate services.
So true. We merged with another organization. A lot of people remember us as Forest Guardians. That's who we were for 18 years before we merged with Sinapu in January 28th of this year. And that merger has been so powerful for us, because we gained so many economies of scale and now are able to work west-wide doing the work that we do best. And you're exactly right. If we don't look for the opportunities to collaborate, to merge where it makes sense, we won't be as effective as we need to be. And given that we count on people to fund us, it's so important that they be able to count on us to be as effective and efficient as we possibly can be. And, you know, that's one thing that the opportunity of this economic, new economic reality, as Mary Charlotte called it, is that it gives us the opportunity to look at what do we do best, mm-hmm. How can we be even more effective at it, who can we work with to expand our reach, or at least, you know, keep our reach where it was, and see what's positive about it.
And at the same time, we have to remember what is our mission and what's our identity, because there are some places that, you know, Youth Shelters has been in this community for almost 29 years, and many of the things we do, we are the only organization in town that does it. And so we have to be careful, you know, there's a line between collaborating and also maintaining an agency's or a nonprofit's identity, and then looking around and seeing how, you know, how it all fits together. Because if you blur the lines, then, as Diane was saying, you get off mission.
Exactly.
Diane, do we still have you with us for a few more minutes?
You do. This is an important conversation, and I'll stop breathing heavily now because I'm not breathing anymore.
Well, we would like to say that committed directors of nonprofit organizations in Santa Fe are willing to talk to us from their cell phones while running through airports to go see their family right before Christmas, ladies and gentlemen. No, it's quite something. Because I wanted to bring up with you, as with our other two guests here before we leave, this whole question of how our society is so much more heavily dependent on nonprofits to do things that are supported by governments in other societies. So a huge amount of time and money goes toward fundraising from private sources, what is considered a right and just a normal part of what government does. In other words, taxpayers pay in and government provides these services, whether they be artistic or environmental or social. Diane, how do you see that? Do you wish that there were more government funding of the arts for the kind of thing that you do?
Well, obviously, we are all ambivalent about that sort of discussion. On one level, yes, we'd love to have our tax dollars going to things that matter to us. But when governments support things, certainly in this country, they take with that support an aspect of control of content and of methodology of delivery. And so there is always a compromise that's made if you're going to take federal, state, or local money. it's an important compromise. It's a compromise that makes us think harder and more carefully about what we do and how we provide it. But I think that there is something in our country about the role the government plays in terms of supporting almost any activity. Having said that, the idea that the government doesn't support the arts is something that is historically very, very loaded. Until the Depression, when under Franklin Delano Roosevelt they first formed the WPA and gave artists and writers jobs, real jobs like the rest of the world, where you provided a product and you got paid for it, we had never supported the arts as a nation through federal mandate and federal rulings. But even then, it was created by fiat under Roosevelt. And as soon as the Second World War started and we geared up for other things and the economy stabilized a little, the WPA came to a crashing halt. And it wasn't actually until 64 under Johnson when there was a public mandate to support the arts. And if not for the WPA, most cities in our nation would not have theaters, would not have museums, would not have all sorts of institutions to support and to disseminate and to the arts and to engage people in the arts. But it's really under the new society, the young great society that Johnson established the endowments for the arts and humanities, and they have been troubled and have had a roller coaster life ever since their establishment. And one of the things that is obvious is that in terms of our particular nation, the arts are not prioritized very highly. What they have missed is most of our deep history, most of our cultural continuity is documented, supported, and disseminated by the arts. That these are the ways in which all levels of our communities get a voice. They can speak their minds, they can tell their own stories, and our history is enriched dramatically by that. And so one of the things that arts organizations do is not only create creators and support the people who make the art, but they also end up supporting and developing new audiences, people who will come to love the arts. And that really matters.
When you talk about arts organizations, then the question arises, and it's this. We'll talk about this with our other two guests as well, but I want to give you time before you get on that airplane, is when you have, I mean, a nonprofit corporation is still a corporation. Should it be and is it run the same way that a corporation is run? Obviously, the mission of a corporation is to make money. The mission of an arts organization is to further its mission in the arts. But in terms of how it's managed, in terms of how it runs its day-to-day operations, how helpful is a corporate model?
Well, it's interesting. It's not really a matter of corporate models, though there are certain legal aspects of corporations that have to be very carefully adhered to. I think that the idea of profit, the idea of earning income, the idea of making money has been forced almost on a lot of the nonprofit sector. There is some sense that if you're providing important services, somehow there's a value to it that you could get money back for it. But the truth of the matter is all good business models, whether it's for-profit or non-for-profit, have to cleave to better business practices, transparency, integrity, honesty. I mean, doing the best and the most that you can. And the one aspect of these online, you know, organizations that rank nonprofits is that they really do track how much of the dollars you take in as donations actually go to doing what you say you do. And, you know, it's kind of startling to go online sometimes because rather revered nonprofit organizations oftentimes only deliver about 20% of a dollar to the services that they claim are their mission. smaller nonprofits and leaner nonprofits, and you've got them around your table right now, are often nonprofits that deliver somewhere between 75 and 85% of every dollar to the services that they are empowered as by their mission to provide or to pursue. And that's a critical mass. I guess one of the things that I would say is, for the last 10 or 15 years, the cry has been that nonprofits have to become more corporate. But I think what we have learned by the disasters of the corruption and the greed and the dishonesty and the lack of transparency in corporate America is that perhaps corporations need to learn to be a little more like nonprofits, a little more geared toward doing what they say they do, doing it as well as is humanly possible, and doing it by using those dollars in their most effective way.
And I'd like to add to that, doing it with a consciousness that there are other benefits besides the dollar that need to be thought of in every action that even a for-profit company takes. So if you're dumping something into the river, it should be cleaned up before it gets dumped into the river, and it should be cleaned up by you, the person who's doing the dumping.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, that idea of being part of a community, which every nonprofit has as its core, the corporations seem to see themselves as somehow sort of freelance powers. And what they do is about their bottom line, and the rest of it becomes irrelevant. And I think that with the economy crashing, a lot of those corporate entities are going to have to rethink how they function within the larger community as well, or at least we hope they will.
We're talking to Diane Karp from the Santa Fe Art Institute, Carol Norton from Wild Earth Guardians, and Karen Rowell from Youth Shelters and Family Services. I noticed, Karen, you were nodding when Diane was talking about nonprofits that maximize their use of each dollar and minimize the amount spent on overhead.
Yes. First of all, I wanted to say I was really impressed with what Diane was saying. And, you know, you have to maximize every dollar that you get. There is, you know, when you are dealing with government funding, there's always the need. You have to report. You have to. In human services have to have outcomes. We have to report on, you know, did our work make a change and how many people. And it's actually very cumbersome. And, you know, in most government contracts, whether it's state or federal, they really want that to go to direct service providers. What gets lost in all this is it takes people like a finance person and like the secretary to answer the phone to make the agency go as a whole. And so people have to be willing, you know, watch the bottom line. Hello, you have to be able to wear five hats. You know, today I'm the executive director. Tomorrow I might be plunging a toilet or, you know, providing services to a kid at street outreach.
And so they want you to provide services, but also to provide these reports
absolutely.
That are comprehensive and auditable without actually spending staff time doing it.
Well, and when you don't have the infrastructure, I mean, when I look at, you know, 6-8 years ago where we were doing this on these HMIS systems and, you know, the computers that it's a management information system for reporting. And all we had in our agency were donated computers, you know, 386s and, you know, things that we had put together and, you know, and so you wait to upload and like you're waiting. But in order to get your next drawdown of money, you have to report those figures. I have no problem with watching our performance, watching our bottom line, because if we don't watch the bottom line, you know, then we have to look at which staff person do we have to lay off, which service can we not provide, and it's not an option for us not to provide services when we're talking about kids who have nowhere else to go. However, you know, there has to be a balance and an acknowledgement that we need to do our work and we need to be accountable, but it can't be so cumbersome that we spend more time, you know, making reports and doing evaluations than we do in actually providing services.
It's been a great learning experience for me. Having spent 10 years in corporate America working for Intel, I come with a business background, and I don't think John Horning, our executive director, would have hired me if he didn't value that to some degree. I hope I brought other skill sets as well. But there was the day when I got to work at Intel and I put my laptop down on my desk and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I need to follow my heart and go work, do the work that's important to me. And
namely environmental work.
Environmental work, environmental advocacy, just really the advocacy piece of it. And so I began work at Wild Earth Guardians, and sure, I think some of the systems is important, and we've implemented some of those systems. And yet, what I spent the first year learning was, because it is a different situation, it is a nonprofit where teamwork is more important than competitiveness. It's not about a single person. It's about all of you working together to wear the five hats. And the dedication and commitment of the people in the organization that get things done. That it's a balance. And so you're right. We want to be as efficient as possible. And what allows us to do that it's very different than corporate America in that it's a commitment, a consciousness about the work we're doing and the way we do that work.
And you know, I just want to comment on that is. You know, in this economic downturn, we're going to have to look inside of our organizations to get the work done. And so different than corporate America where people want to get ahead and they, you know, what is it, on the back of their colleague or something. What is so amazing to me about nonprofit work is that the commitment is to the mission. And so, you know, we serve over 1,000 youth and their family every year. And so we have people that are committed to that work. And, you know, it's not a high-paying job, and we try to create an environment that draws people to work because they like their colleagues, they're dedicated to the mission of the program. And so then you get the integrity, you get the what we were talking about earlier, the spirit, the holistic, environmental way. How do we make our organization sustainable so we can be here tomorrow when someone needs us?
Right.
Diane, are you still with us?
I am still with you.
And
I'm learning. I'm so honored to be with these other nonprofit directors because clearly we are all in this together, and the purpose is to make our society more civil, more humane, and healthier.
Now, something I know that you, Diane, have spent a lot of time thinking about is how to make the work environment itself a place that is wonderful for people to work at, and they, therefore, are productive and don't burn out.
Exactly, and that's so complicated when the funding goes down because you have less support, you have less resources to call on, and it never fails that those are the moments in time when burnout rises as a larger and larger possibility. We have been absolutely adamant that as best as we can, we are not going to lose any of our staff people because each of them works 150% of the time, literally. A 40-hour week doesn't exist in a nonprofit. If there's a youth shelter that has a program on a Tuesday night, we show up not only with the arts materials and the great artists from the community as teachers, but we also show up with pizza and with juice and with a sense of saying to these kids, your voice matters. It needs to be heard. You need to be engaged in the conversations that are the conversations about who we are in this world and how our city, Santa Fe, functions. And, you know, oftentimes these are kids who have fled situations that are the sort of rigid, keep them in the box, this is how you think, this is how you speak, and they need to know that we want to hear them. We want to know what they think. We care about their ideas because more often than not, these are the kids who are more innovative and more creative than you can possibly imagine. Otherwise, they wouldn't have managed to survive to get to the youth shelter, to get some help, and begin to rethink their lives.
I just want to say, Diane, amen. Amen. Thank you.
We love working with you guys. What you do is astounding. And we see our programming as being a support for you. We don't expect you to be art specialists. We don't expect you to be able to do everything, just as our job is not psychological counseling. It's not what we do. But when we work with these young people together, we basically convince them, hopefully for the rest of their lives, that they can be stewards of their environment, that they can be leaders in their community, and we give them this vehicle, this alternative pathway to have a powerful, powerful voice. And many of them are leaders. So instead of being gang leaders, they end up being community leaders. It's astounding.
Well, as we say, every kid is worth it.
You bet.
Now, when I first moved to Santa Fe, I met somebody who had been a director of a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. that was doing some really important activist work during the Reagan era. And he became the director of this nonprofit. And when he went in, he said, everybody is working 40 hours a week. Unless there's an emergency or a big deadline, you are leaving at 5 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, he would pack his briefcase, and everybody would say, what are you doing? We have so much work to do. And he said, I'm going home. And he instituted a day where the whole staff would go hiking or rafting or something like that. And within a pretty short time, all the other nonprofits came to him and said, how is it that you guys get so much work done?
You know, it's an interesting perspective and an interesting way to approach it. Diane has said there's no such thing as a 40-hour work week. That tends to be the case. It's also very important to when you're dealing with issues that are so urgent. I mean, particularly right now with this, you know, where we are economically and with the administration that we've had for the last 8 years, the issues are, they're just breathing down our necks. I mean, we have to deal with it. So
okay.
It is important to have the...
I have to just honor what all of you do and thank you for doing it, including Mary Charlotte, because we know the KSFR is a nonprofit that serves our community in extraordinary ways. I got to get off the phone. Have a wonderful holiday.
Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah, Diane. And thank you so much for being with us, joining us from the airport, the Albuquerque airport. Diane Karp of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Have a safe trip.
Happy holidays.
Peace. Happy holidays, peace. Diane.
Bye.
Be safe.
Just to finish, it's the teamwork, working together. So, I mean, today we went for our year-end lunch. It was great. It's so important for us to take those moments because we're so often in breakdown. To have a moment to break through where we can just hang out with each other is really, really great.
And laugh and have a good time.
Clearly.
Yeah. I'm practicing the 40-hour week. It's a challenge, and I agree. I think you have to take a break, and you have to know that your limits, and that there's always something else to do. And so, we really try to keep our staff to 40 hours a week. We really, you know, we're staffed 24 hours a day in two programs, and we do have crises that come up that we have to attend to. And you know, we try to encourage a very healthy workplace. Sometimes we're more successful at that than others. And I need to practice it better myself.
I would like to say on behalf of KSFR, which, as Diane pointed out, is also a nonprofit organization, the way I see the station's work and my own work is it's a way of really tying together all the many threads in this community. And so we're a nonprofit. We ask for donations twice a year, and people can donate anytime at ksfr.org, and some people do. And but understanding the importance of that is something that, I mean, that people take for granted. Our donations, in terms of our numbers of donations, are not down. People do understand what we're doing, but the dollar amounts are down. And
yes.
So always, and I think that's probably true for both of your organizations and the Art Institute as well, for more people to get on board, to understand what we're doing and see themselves as part of it, even if it's only a few bucks or a little bit of volunteer time, is incredibly important.
I was doing a little research before I came over here, and we have demographic information for a lot of our New Mexico members. The majority of people who we have information for, so there could be some filter there, make between $30,000 and $40,000 and donate to us. I feel so lucky. The generosity in this community is phenomenal. I am grateful every day.
Amen. I'm overwhelmed at this time of year at the generosity of the community, and we are seeing a change. We are seeing people who are writing checks. They may not be as much as they have been before, but they're still donating. But you know, this is our time of year. We about 35% of our budget is based on donations and foundation giving. And so we're cautiously optimistic, and we're watching, and we've had a lot of great press. We've had been on the radio several times. But it's a really important time for us, and we're seeing that people are still giving, but it's at a lower level. And so as we watch our holiday campaign unfold, we're saying, okay, so what do we need to do? What are we going to do to go forward to make sure that, you know, we can meet our budget, and without being in fear, but more being in looking ahead, because it, you know, our major donor campaign is down some, and we will have to be watchful, as we always are anyway, but in a different kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is that people understand the urgency of the issues. I mean, and also the opportunities. So. Mm-hmm. We're clearly in transition economically, politically, possibly spiritually. And Barack Obama says it best, you know, what's possible in this new situation. And, you know, economic doubt, I think what people see, at least from the environmental perspective, and I presume that there's the same kinds of things from Karen's perspective, from Diane's perspective, is that, you know, yes, we're having an economic downturn. It's more difficult to write a big check, and at the same time, there's and the opportunity that comes with that. There's less extraction right now because people are using less. People are beginning to make the transition to a new economy. There'll be less golf courses built in the next 5 years, I guarantee it. And so they see that, and that presents an opportunity. I mean, now
so
is the time.
So in economic downturn, there is an opportunity, for example, to realize some of the goals of the environmental movement.
Absolutely, to solidify the wins that we've made in the last couple of years and to have new wins, to take extra steps. And so they see that. And a lot of people who've been following our year-end e-appeal, the appeal that we do through email, about 10,000 people get that email. It's a 10-chapter story about Wyatt the Wolf, and Wyatt is looking back 150 years to the way it was, and counting what's, and looking and recounting how what it looked like and what it could be, and how we can get there. And here are the very concrete steps in the next year that we can take to get to the place, to get closer to a whole sustainable environment, one that is nurturing to all of us. And it's been fun.
I just want to say that I think that the key word here is we have to create opportunity. That, you know, the economic downturn, it's scary. So what do we do with that? And I think you're exactly right, is we have to see how do we create change. How do we shift into where's the opportunity in this? And, you know, you're exactly right. More volunteers. I think gratitude, you know, being grateful for what we have before we start talking about what we don't have. And, you know, and looking at different ways that we can use our resources. And, you know, again, I go back to collaboration. But that's really the key here, is where do we create the opportunities? And, you know, as an organization, how do we even broaden our continuum of services so maybe we don't duplicate, or, you know, we do things with more kids together rather than separately?
Well, one of the things I'm really glad here is that we have people from the arts and environment and social services talking to each other, because in your busy lives, there probably aren't that many opportunities to do so. A thing that I think is also a big question is, when you were putting together your board of directors. You're a nonprofit organization, and then you are bringing people in who often are from the for-profit community in one way or another because they have money, because they have connections to people who have money, but they really represent the bridge between understanding what the organization is about and asking people who are more really in the corporate sector and the corporate mindset to start supporting it. And there are great stories and there are horror stories in terms of people on boards not understanding the mission of their own organization.
We're very lucky in that our board is just involved, and they're great advocates, and they are a bridge. And what people are what they're helping their organizations, their friends understand is that there is as much value and as much you get as much back from service as you do from consumerism. And to the extent that that can be incorporated into their own business, their friends' businesses, that sector of the economy, the happier they may be. And the more involved they are in their community, the more that they work with the community, the more that they and their families will feel part of the community, which, you know, before we were consumers, we were community.
I think we did a show recently on the importance of shopping locally and what happens when a dollar goes into the local economy versus when it goes to a big box store and basically gets shipped out of state. And I would like to say that I think, especially in a place like Santa Fe, I don't know about other cities, local for-profit businesses that are locally owned, many of them are extraordinarily supportive and understanding of the missions of organizations like all of ours.
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. And I want to go back to just say something about our board, because I think we have an incredible board. I'm so grateful to their reach into the community. And that's really how I think a board gives. You have all the stuff about boards giving monetarily, but how they give is through their efforts and how they connect us with the community, whether they're in state government and they can help us with other, you know, entities in state government, or they're with, you know, have connections to the county or into the business community. And so they are the word spreaders. They are the storytellers. You know, we're over here, we're doing our work, and we're, you know, we sit at our desk or we provide our services to kids. And to have boards who are so committed that they're telling our story out into the community to continue to educate, it's like the ripple effect that goes out and out into the community, and that is so important.
And I highly encourage anyone who is interested in being on a board, who has a particular nonprofit or service that they're interested in, to look into it, because it is a great service to this community. And you're right, Mary Charlotte, the Santa Fe business community are completely inspiring. They help so many of us, over and over again, and they put their names out there. They provide volunteers, and it's phenomenal.
Speaking of volunteers, all of our organizations are organizations that depend on volunteers, and I think that when people get, and this is happening quite a lot, especially, well, and I think in all sectors, but especially where the environmental movement is concerned, there's this sense, particularly with global warming and climate change, that this irreversible, gigantic disaster is about to happen. And it's sort of like being on a river in a boat that's really going fast toward the waterfall, and you're just waiting to go over the edge, and you feel like there's nothing you can do about it. Well, this idea of starting where you are and working with what you've got. I didn't do very well, but I went to the tree planting last year that Wild Earth Guardians sponsored, and just basically showing up for one night of camping and planting a tree. There was a family there that brought their kids every year, and that's what they did. And the number of people all around the city who do things like that is phenomenal. Then there are many people who say, gosh, I'd like to do something, but don't quite know where to begin. And I just want to sort of have the call out to people to contact you guys. What are some of the volunteers top-tier opportunities with youth shelters and family services?
Well, they can work in our street outreach center where we provide services to kids who live out on the street. We have several different programs in our shelter where they can volunteer. They can also just volunteer to hang out with the kids at the shelter.
What's that all about, volunteer to hang out with the kids at the shelter?
Well, our shelter is provides services to kids 11 through their 17th year. And basically kids go there because they've run away, they're in crisis, they've been taken from their homes, they're in between foster care placements, or there's nowhere for them to go and there's no one to take care of them. So our shelter has a very homey environment. The kids cook the meals together. They sit down and eat together. They do homework together. And so, you know, a volunteer can go and play games with them. They can do art projects, as Diane was talking about. They can go in the kitchen with them and help them to get dinner on the table, do the dishes, do the laundry, take them on outings. And we have this wonderful garden plot, and it's a raised bed in the backyard that we're hoping that in this spring that we can find someone to come and actually help the kids to grow their own vegetables. It's a great little spot. It has drip irrigation. We just need somebody to come and kind of give us some guidance.
What, how do people contact you, for example, if a gardener is listening right now?
Well, they can contact us at 983-0586, or they can go to youthshelters.org, and they can look on our website for different volunteer opportunities and contact us through the website.
And that activity of growing food is productive on so many levels.
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, and you know, when I left this morning, our street outreach staff was in our shelter kitchen with shelter kids cooking food for our young people who come to our street outreach. So it's really a community, and we provide a holiday meal for the youth who are homeless, who are marginally housed, who are unattached, unaccompanied out on the street. And it was such a great thing to have these young people in the shelter, and the food was provided, you know, through other organizations in town. So, I mean, it was a collaboration from start to end. And so now we have all these kids over there having a great meal, and they'll have leftovers to take away with them.
We've just got a minute or two left. What are some of the volunteer opportunities at Wild Earth Guardians?
Anything you want to do, we're happy to work with you. Mary Charlotte, you mentioned our tree planting program, and that happens in the spring, so it's coming up, and it's great. We'll have 300 people connect to the environment by planting a tree, and you talked about on the boat going down the river and the climate change that's coming. The one thing that we can do is make ecosystems more resilient, so that in the face of the change that's coming, they'll be able to withstand that and stay healthy. Tree planting is one of the best things that you can do. Planting a garden also connects you very much to the earth and to our nature. So come out and plant trees with us. The schedule's already up on the website.
And the website is?
WildEarthGuardians.org.
Thank you.
You're welcome to call Lori Colt. Lori Colt is the glue of our organization. It's amazing. I've never seen anyone get so much done in so little time.
She's so great. She's really nice.
Unbelievably effective. And one of the things that really helps us is to have people come in and help her. So tomorrow, three people are coming in just to help us get our year-end mailing out. My gosh, you know, so simple. And it makes a huge difference
for
us.
And we like volunteers like that who would come in and help us do office work and do some filing or help us with mailings. Because those kinds of things are big jobs, and it's great to have help with that.
And it's fun. I mean, it creates community. One of the things that we really want is to have a tribe of people who love us, who we love, we all work for the same thing. It's very inspiring.
And the number at Wild Earth Guardians is 988-9126, where you can talk to Lori Colt and everybody else there. I want to thank you both all so much for being with us. Diane Karp, who was with us earlier from the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Karen Rowell from Youth Shelters and Family Services right here in Santa Fe, and Carol Norton from Wild Earth Guardians. And thank you so much for the work you do in this community.
And thank you, KSFR, for all you do.
Thank
in
you.
This community. And thank you, Mayor Charlotte.
Thank you, Radio Cafe. Thank you to our Mayor David Koss, to our Governor
absolutely.
Bill Richardson, and to the community. Thank you, all of you. Karen's been great.
Yeah. Great
and
to meet you.
Merry Christmas and happy holidays. Yeah.
Happy
Thank
holidays.
You. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Gabalucci for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Tomorrow is Christmas Eve, and tomorrow we're going to be playing Christmas music and talking about Christmas music from all around the world. So keep your dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station, one of the many nonprofit organizations in this city. Hasta la vista. Ciao.